The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Michael Slaby. Michael is a global leader in digital and social media strategy, technology, and data analytics. He was the chief integration and innovation officer for the 2012 Obama for America campaign and the chief technology officer for the 2008 Obama campaign. Those went pretty well. He is head of mission at Timshell, a company working to help solve social, civic, and humanitarian problems via technology. He was previously a fellow at the Shorenstein Center at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Michael, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I was prepping for our conversation, and I look for themes. And one of the themes I thought I saw cropping up in your work, and you are, you know, free to tell me I'm wrong, is the suggestion that so many of us, and this is in business, in politics, and in life, have a core misunderstanding of how to tap into the real power of digital communication, that we are still applying a lot of old thinking to what is essentially an entirely new world.
I wish I'd started out thinking that was my theme. That sounds really good.
Can we make it your theme?
I think we just did.
Okay. Or is it not?
This is further evidence of better to be lucky than good.
Yeah.
I do think that's a big part of my career. It's a big part of it's emblematic of how I got into technology and how I got into this space, which was a little bit by accident and not through the front door.
Right.
When thinking about how the world has changed, you know, I do think that most of our conversations around the power of digital engagement, the power of these new tools, tends to be hyper-tactical.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We tend to start with, because it's tangible and it's something that we can easily sort of grasp onto, you know, my organization wants to reach more people. How do I use Twitter?
Right.
And that's a completely legitimate question and an important one, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of opportunity there to engage people in new ways, to drive conversation, to participate and listen, but it's not the right place to start.
Right.
That we talk a lot about in a world that is more networked, in a world that is less linear,
mm-hmm.
in a world where communications is no longer just about fragmentation and about how to find an audience. It's about how to build community.
Right.
That, you know, the most durable marketing metaphor in the world, the funnel.
Right.
The most offensive marketing metaphor I could probably think of, right? It's like putting people through a meat grinder.
Right. Right.
It is this inherently impersonal, inherently linear process, and that's just not what the world looks like.
Right. Right. It's funny because I found this quote that you said. You said, in the new world, we need to replace which channel with which paths, with which audience, with which community.
And all of that is it comes out of rethinking communications instead of being channel and linear and thinking about all communications as a graph.
Right.
Right? That's all language that comes from graph theory and math.
Yeah.
And the number of connections we have between us as individuals or organizations and others has to do with how many edges, how many connecting points do we have between us and each other. Some of them are direct, some of them are indirect, some of them are free, some of them are paid, some of them are bidirectional. Right? But that variation changes, you know, the sort of the solution set for ways to engage you is a much larger matrix than it used to be.
Yeah.
That means more opportunity. That means greater capacity for us as leaders of movements or communities or institutions or organizations or campaigns. We have more opportunity to drive more of our own conversation, create more of our own content, listen as an institution. Listening is not a skill most institutions have ever had to have.
Oh, and individuals are notoriously terrible at it.
Yeah,
I mean, we are. We have a wonderful practice exercise at Second City that we teach when we have people to teach them how poor they are at listening. So one of the things that you have to do is you have a conversation and you can't speak until you've said the last word that I just said.
So I have got it. Interesting.
Yeah. And so it really forces you to listen to the end. And what you discover is that you have this jarring conversation because the rhythm doesn't work because you were preparing about halfway through my sentence for how you were going to respond to sound intelligent, to sound clear.
And you're thinking more about what you're going to say than what is being said.
Yeah.
It's an interesting point. And I think this world that we live in, you know, we don't have... We're still used to, especially at the level of institutional communications, we're used to linear, right? Linear is easier.
Sure.
Linear is simpler. Most of the tools that we have are based on linear ideas. Mm-hmm. And so we tend to still optimize channels, right?
Yep.
And each of these edges is essentially a channel. The problem is we can no longer ignore the interconnectedness. We can no longer – Let me rephrase. To our peril, we ignore the connectedness.
Right.
And we miss opportunities, and we miss the opportunity to be more human in the way we interact and the way we build community. I'm strongly of the belief that at this stage of the game, all marketing is community building. Mm-hmm. Right? And if that's not the mentality, if the mentality is not how can we inspire people to be part of what we're trying to achieve, you're going to be left feeling flat. You're going to be left feeling uninspired, inauthentic, and transactional. And none of those things are a good way to build a movement.
Absolutely. Before, and I do want to talk about the campaign a bit because I think people are curious and I'm curious about it. But before that, I want to key in on a thing you said. So there's an improv phrase, which is make accidents work for you. And
nice.
you talked about you getting into here in this field was an accident. What was the accident?
The accident was I majored in a combination of creative writing and biochemistry.
Yeah, you did.
Which sounds like an accident in and of itself.
Yes.
And perhaps was the dangerous freedom of Brown University when you're 19.
Oh, God, yeah.
Which is a place that I adore, adored and adore. But I was curious about a lot of things. I was a generalist from a young age, but I got into school I was getting to graduation, and I didn't really know how to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
I took some time off. I stumbled into graphic design, and I sort of came into design and communications and technology through the window of graphic design and motion graphics and some of these kinds of things. And this was 99, 2000. This was sort of the very early days of the interactive web.
Right.
And it was one of those situations where every time I picked up a new rock to think about ways that we wanted to leverage new tools, I needed to learn more about technology. And so I became, in sort of typical generalist fashion, a sort of poorly trained, which is to say self-taught, generalist, general technologist, but because in order to do much with your design, you needed to be able to leverage technology, and so I had to learn.
Right.
And I was lucky to be in environments where I had bosses and teachers who would just hand me stuff.
Right.
And say Tim Zulig, who ran a boutique web design shop called No Ink, would just hand me projects and say, "We need this in 2 weeks," and he'd say, "I don't care that you don't know how to do this. Learn."
Right.
And it was just sort of a magical, lucky opportunity for me to be in the space. And I ended up developing this very strange skill set, this sort of combination of technical thinking, limited technical skill, good skills around communications, storytelling, narrative, some acceptable skills around design. And you sort of pile these all together. And what that made me good at essentially was I had all these building blocks for where the world ended up going.
Right.
And it was luck, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't well planned. It wasn't definitively thought out.
Yeah.
People still ask me, like, what should I study if I want to do this? And I tell most of them that they should try to be writers.
Sure.
That at the end of the day, the interconnectedness we're talking about communication and media and technology is this is a graph, but it also sort of is essentially a circulatory system, and the blood is content.
Yeah.
Right. The thing that inspires people to respond and act and engage is always a story, whether it's long form, short form, video, tweet, whatever. It's always about content one way or another. And so the ability to write is fundamental to the ability to inspire, engage, drive interaction, drive sales, drive like in lots of contexts. And so it is an incredibly undervalued skill.
I love the fact that I've got what most people would conceive of as the data guy in here, and we're already onto storytelling. You know, the other thing about not knowing where the world goes, you know, I started out at Second City in 1988, pre-internet, really. And then you wake up one day and you realize that the world is all about short-form content and interactive content, what we've been trafficking
which you've been
since
doing
1959.
From the beginning.
Yeah. So,
So either it's all new again, or it's all, what is the phrase?
I don't know. You know, for me, what it is, here's the beautiful irony.
If you haven't seen it, it's new to you.
Right. Well, that's true. And the fact that we were able to craft and hone our methodology without any sort of interference or really looking for other sort of profit angles or productizing for really like a couple decades.
Right.
What a gift.
Yeah.
And then being able to sort of, once you really knew your stuff, then take it out. And that's what we do now, where we're, you know, working with Parkinson's patients, and we're working with Fortune 500 companies, and we're immersed at universities talking about leadership. I mean, one of the things that you talked about with regard to looking at the world differently, you know, for us is so much of busting up hierarchies. You know, top down doesn't work. The leadership is a dynamic. You have to, there's a great improv phrase called follow the follower. Great leaders need to know when to follow and when to lead. And that changes throughout. One of the things that I found very interesting in a description about the first Obama campaign was it was described, the team was described as something like a tech startup whose product sort of just happened to be a presidential candidate. I mean, is that an apt description, or is it a little more nuanced than that?
I think in certain contexts that's an apt description. I think what is apt about it is that startups are blank pages.
Yep.
That gives you a lot of freedom. You start a political campaign, especially a challenger, insurgent, unlikely in some regards, campaign.
Hugely unlikely. I mean, let's take a moment.
Think about the timing, right? So it's hard to remember now as a, you know, two-term president that the then Senator Obama from Illinois with the funny name was a truly long shot.
Dangerous name, I'd say.
In a field.
Dangerous
middle
name.
Yes. In a field of very strong, accomplished candidates.
Yes.
And that is also in some ways similar to a startup.
Yeah.
There's a necessity of belief and an inherent, you know, the boundaries between optimism and insanity are fine lines. And so, you know, you have this internal community of people who believe in something greater and beyond, you know, the individual tasks at hand. And then you have this, you know, incredibly brilliant leader in David Plouffe, you know, thinking about the political reality and empowering people like Joe Rosbars, who is our digital director. We used to call it new media.
Okay, back then?
Back when it was new primary. We were desperate. We were going to lose a traditional primary.
Right.
And David Plouffe and Joe Rosbars and David Axelrod, these are extremely smart people. And that meant that we needed to turn it into a non-traditional primary. And that meant new people. And that meant new mechanisms. That meant new opportunities. We also, by the way, had none of the traditional infrastructure on our side. So it wasn't like we had an option.
Right.
It wasn't like we were choosing between, you know, leveraging strong established state party structures or using the internet.
Yeah.
We didn't have a choice.
You didn't have a Koch brother nearby.
No, we didn't have a choice, right? So there's a couple, we get a little credit, sometimes a little too much credit for the forethought around that. And there's also the great saying that I always attribute to Chris Sacco, which is, I don't know where he got it, is timing has a lot to do with the success of a rain dance. And 2007 is also a really important sort of technical moment, right? Because Twitter had launched in mid-2006, beginning of 2007. There was, you know, 50,000 users on Twitter. It was tiny. Facebook had, About a year or so earlier, opened up to non-EDU addresses, so it was now finally open to the general public.
Right.
And so this was these were some of the shifts that started to reconnect the fragmented landscape that we were used to talking to into a network, right? Making media portable between forms. It was the sharing behavior made and the sort of ease of publishing and the instantaneous publishing of these kinds of platforms that has really reshaped the media, the landscape in which we consume information. And so these things happened, right, just to be, they happened and were available to us as the first people to do it.
Right.
And then there was this political necessity, and so we ran with it.
This idea of the source of innovation sometimes being desperation is important. And it's important in the sense of anyone who is looking to be innovative. One of the key hallmarks is really an orientation. And I think that orientation is to see things that are in front of you as gifts instead of obstacles.
Sure. I agree with that. I think opportunism, I would go so far as to say it, institutionally, it's a culture of thinking about opportunities differently, thinking about a willingness to question inertia, a willingness. And this is one of the places where campaigns are easy environments in some regards to establish this kind of culture because you don't have institutional memory.
Right.
Those are blank pages.
Yeah.
And so you can imagine them however you want them to be. And there's some simple things that happened early on that really made a difference in our ability to leverage. Digital is also a behavior. It's a force multiplier for other things, right? On a presidential campaign or any campaign, you basically have to do three things to excel. You got to raise money, you got to deliver messages, and you got to mobilize people. And money, message, mobilization. This is the drumbeat, right? The modern political campaign has basically been the same since Mark Hanna, William McKinley's campaign manager in 1996. The tools change, but the mechanisms. But so now that we have digital tools, it doesn't become money, message, mobilization, and Twitter, right? The Twitter and digital becomes ways of doing these other things better, larger scale, faster, more effectively, more efficiently. Data becomes a way of measuring the efficiency and effectiveness of things so that we are careful with resources, but digital as a layer across an organization, there was a very early decision, and I don't even know how intentional it was, but it was really important, which was Joe Rosebars, who I mentioned before, reported directly to David Plouffe. He did not report to the communications director.
Huh.
And that seems like a tiny, subtle, random organizational detail, but it meant that digital as a layer was simpler because we weren't in one department. We were in our own. We had this ability to stretch. This ability to work across how field organizing is inspiring and training and acquiring volunteers, how we're acquiring and inspiring donors. All these different sort of touch points for the community that we were engaging. We got to be part of all those conversations.
Right.
And that was a very significant choice.
Sure. It requires that you're in the room. And this is a thing, right? Because we see how IT is treated with regard to, down the hall, so many people are down the hall. And again, a great improv phrase, all of us are so much better than one of us. And I think in you talk about this, right? The importance of putting that person in the room because that's where the ideas are.
Well, and I think we have a tendency sometimes to do strategic work backwards, where we start a strategic process with a tiny team and we end up with implementation being the responsibility of a large team, and particularly with technology. And that's more or less backwards,
right?
That if we can start the conversation with a larger team with more perspectives, with technologists and folks thinking about data and measurement at the table early in the process to ask informative questions and then make decisions as a group and then empower a small team to implement, we're likely to get to a more expansive solution more quickly than, and this happens in all kinds of organizations. Rather than in a place where you have folks who are brilliant and thoughtful in their own specialties extrapolating and guessing about what might be possible with technology rather than being informed, which usually, by the way, ends up being too narrow.
Right.
So we are generally speaking, we fail in technology and digital because we lack enough ambition,
right?
Not because we have too much.
There, one of the things that in preparation for this, I write down some improv phrases that might apply, might not. And I'm looking at one right now, which says, follow the process and the product will follow.
Mm.
Which is, I think, a little bit, you know, what you're talking about, and so interesting that, again, a world of data and technology, which I, you know, am not comfortable with. That's not something I grew up with or even understand. And my kids make fun of me all the time with regard to this. but the mirror into human behaviors and the connection to human behaviors seem a lot the same.
Yeah.
That, you know, the same mistakes that we make as people. And it's funny. We're on the phone with some scientists at IBM, and we were talking about trying to teach their robots to improvise, and the guy just goes, oh, robots, terrible improvisers. It's just such a funny sort of comment, but like he thought about it and he's like, oh yeah, no,
they would be awful at that.
Yeah, really bad at that. Tell me about your new company. So how long has Tim Shaw been around?
3 years. Almost 3 years.
What do you guys do?
Our goal is to help elevate the way the social impact community solves big problems. And
okay.
We go about that by helping close the technology deficit mm-hmm. in the nonprofit community, building better technology platforms to help enable organizations to engage their communities more effectively, more fearlessly with better tools, higher performance, those kinds of questions,
right.
And to measure the effectiveness of what they're doing with greater clarity. And then around that sort of technical foundation around building platforms, recognizing that this culture change and that building capabilities and capacity is necessary for the leverage of technology. We also talk a lot about building capabilities,
right.
And that is a question of sharing best practices, building content, building community, and doing work directly with organizations to help build this culture that supports the leverage of tools.
Hmm.
That technology alone is insufficient to the challenge.
Do you just non-for-profit, or do you work with for-profit as well?
Both. Yeah. We think about the social impact community, I use that phrase on purpose,
mm-hmm.
Broadly, right?
Yeah.
Anyone who's trying to solve a big problem.
Right.
You know, and those are governments, nonprofits, NGOs, but also increasingly corporations and brands who see both a responsibility and a habit, and a good habit of spending resources on things like CSR and employee engagement, but also an increasing both opportunity and there's sometimes some real challenge around seeing consumers and employees expecting more from the companies and brands that they're associated with.
Right.
That there's a new study, seems like every month, about millennials making purchase decisions based on impact and purpose considerations. And I don't think this is a purely millennial phenomenon by any means. I think it shows up there easily in the data.
Yeah.
I think everyone wants their lives to be one of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be affiliated with things that matter. And businesses increasingly recognize their opportunity to engage people in deeper ways,
yeah.
Right? That the ways that the purely transactional mechanisms of building consumer communities aren't as effective, aren't as sticky, aren't as loyal, and that solving real problems with people and for people is a massive opportunity for businesses to play a more interesting role in the communities in which they operate, whether those are, again, employees, shareholders, stakeholders, consumers. This is not just a B2C marketing conversation. This is really about rethinking the culture of companies. And they spend billions of dollars on this already, which
right.
is wonderful, right? The last study I think I saw was something like $18 billion a year
yeah.
on various forms of social impact, which is great. And I love that commitment, but it's not enough,
mm-hmm.
right? Like normal, everyday, individual, religious, non-religious philanthropy. You
right.
and me giving $50 to our friend who's doing a bike ride.
Right.
$200 billion.
Hmm.
Order of magnitude more than
mm-hmm.
the Fortune 1000.
Mm-hmm.
That same Fortune 1000 spends $1 trillion on marketing.
Yeah.
So there's a gap here, which is there is a belief in the value and power of impact. There's an uncertainty about its value to the business. And so we stick with familiar tools around marketing, and some of them work great. I'm not suggesting we spend $1 trillion. Every business should spend $1 trillion
right.
on social impact. But I think if we can help organizations understand the potential for impact to drive their business, things like customer loyalty, things like employee retention. These are meaningful drivers of profitability in a business. With a more quantitative understanding of the relationship between solving a problem, and by that I don't mean how much money you gave away. I mean how much impact are you having on the world, which is a very different question to answer and much harder.
Mm-hmm.
But connecting real understanding about impact, investing in solving problems, and then connecting that to brand value, I think we can pull more of that $1 trillion into the social impact bucket, which is better for everybody.
Yeah, I was talking to a CEO today, and we got into a very interesting conversation along the lines of, she said she had a PowerPoint with all the tweets that have taken companies down.
Mm.
And her big message at the end is, all of this could have been solved with a very quick two words.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. But companies don't do it. And there's the legalese. And then when they get to the I'm sorry, it's way too late.
Yep.
And I found this so funny because it is. It's again, this bridge between technology and human behavior. It's get the ego out of the way and get the fear out of the way.
Right.
Say you're sorry. What an authentic thing to do.
Well, the concept of humility is very poorly understood and undervalued in these contexts, right? The ability to see yourself clearly mm-hmm. and to strive to be better is something that all companies should have. What do I have to offer? What can we do better? This helps drive collaboration. It helps drive, especially when you think about the social impact contexts, there are thousands of organizations all working on the same issues. And rather than seeing themselves as compatriots and comrades in arms around a shared mission, they see each other as competition for donors.
Yeah.
And there's a real lack of willingness to recognize that we need others to get where we want to go. Our version of this is the sort of, if you want to go far, if you want to go fast, go alone. You want to go far, go together.
Yeah.
And these problems are hard.
Yeah.
They are far off. These are long journeys. These are not sprints.
Mm-hmm.
And so figuring out how to collaborate and how to work together and how to allow others to be, and not only allow, but enable others to be successful in the same space with you without fear of your own obsolescence, right? If you really started to solve a problem, obsolescence should be your goal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's on a day-to-day basis when you're trying to make an organization work, that is a tough mentality to maintain.
Sure. And there's this perfection fallacy that exists, you know, where you know, there's some kind of gold standard where there's no mistake.
Mm.
And it doesn't exist. And when you can't bake those into your process, I love the phrase rapid prototyping. And I love it because I apply it to a person on stage trying a bit over and over again until they get it right. It's not just about a machine. And that rapid prototyping is great. What you need then is safe spaces to fail. And inside that also, there is nothing like failing together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about the funniest stories you've got in your life, and they are probably all just terrible, dumb things you did with your friends, you know, or things that happened at the company. We had a guy one time who there was a very senior position that was open, and a bunch of people applied for it, well-known Chicago people, and we made the hire, and he sent out the email to let all these people know that the position had been filled, and he didn't blind CC any of them.
Mm, nice.
So they all saw each other. The phone was ringing off the hook. People were furious, and it was so terrible in the moment, and literally, even maybe 45 minutes later, we were crying. We were laughing so hard.
Yep.
And that kind of failure, again, bonds people, and it's a reality, so use it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I can't. Time flies on these things. We're at our half hour.
My goodness.
Here's what I want from you, though.
Yes.
So I asked you to think about one thing, which is the podcast is called Getting to Yes And. So is there a moment in your life where a no would have been the natural default position, and instead you didn't just say yes, you said yes and to it?
Probably. There are probably a lot of these moments. The one that I, in thinking about this ahead of time, that I really love and was such an obvious no, was how I got into politics.
Yeah.
So I came out of college. I was working in technology. I was doing some stuff, and then the 2004 election happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in D.C., passionate follower of politics, sort of had it in my blood, but never worked in politics. Did some activism stuff as a high school kid, but I wasn't working in politics at the time. And And but I was so frustrated by that election and by what I felt like was, you know, the Democrats are losing to President Bush a second time. And I got into an argument that could be best described as an argument of violent agreement with my best friend. And what came out of this conversation was this, what he intended as a rhetorical question, I think, was if we're so smart, why don't either of us do this for a living?
Right.
And I couldn't let it go. And the most obvious thing would be to keep I'd started a company with a buddy from college. We were doing technology and some interesting things, and the most obvious thing would be to keep doing that.
Right.
To not respond to this rhetorical question. But I couldn't let it go. And so what the yes ended up being, yes, I should be working in politics. Hmm. And I worked it out with my buddy and we shut down this little company. I went to work for Senator Durbin as an intern, and was waiting tables to pay the bills. And that started a whole new path for me. That was a really important choice, because what was underneath that for me is something that I have come to really rely on as a guide, as a North Star, which is I do very poor work when I don't care about what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And that has led me down a path of decisions that are much more about what I think matters, what is important to me and to the world, rather than the more traditional, obvious right step, the thing that sort of you're supposed to do next. And, you know, I went to work for Senator Durbin. I could work as an unpaid staffer for a year.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the thing you're supposed to be doing when you're 28.
No.
But it was the right path for me that led to, I worked in the 06 cycle for a political consulting firm. I landed in the campaign world, and I sort of flung myself at the then Senator Obama's campaign in 07 and more or less said, look, I've developed this extremely strange skill set.
Mm-hmm.
I know campaigns. I know politics. I know digital. I know technology. But I'll take out the trash.
Hmm.
But the yes was reimagining my life as I ought to be working in politics. Then that led to this, you know, set of other decisions that unfolded that I never could have seen coming.
Well, that was the end.
That was the end.
Yeah, that's awesome. This has been Getting to Yes And, and I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor at the Second City. You can find more about Second City and Second City Works at secondcityworks.com. We'll see you next week.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down.
This is Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.